The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering backup solutions that help protect digital data in-home or at work, and offering data recovery services for damaged hard drives or lost files. More info at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening and for giving. Giving that impulse of this Christian holiday, an impulse so festooned with gaudy seasonal decorations, it's sometimes hard to know where in the heart and soul Christmas giving comes from sometimes. If you gave someone a drone for Christmas, know that you are contributing to a glut in the skies. A million other people are hoping to create this holiday season. Depending on the weather this year, I would figure noon is about the right time to check for the humming sound denoting that someone in your neighborhood is now a drone flyer. We should only expect this sound to increase in years to come. You should also know that if drones make you crazy, a totally safe way to neutralize them is with a high-power water hose. The most popular drones cost about $200 to $400 this year, and a spray nozzle that could easily take one out at low altitude very safely is about $45. Just saying. More about the impact of drones this holiday season. Nothing to worry about. But that gift suggestion, a drone, will not necessarily make this a better world. People who are good givers, though, have that goal in mind, much more than pulling pranks. Givers also want to see the result they are having, and this can complicate matters. Often the most visible sign of a gift's impact is that it is closest to the giver. For instance, the museum bequest changes the building or sports arena's name for all to see. Marion Stern is an independent consultant advising public charities on fundraising, board development, and strategic planning. She's also adjunct assistant professor at New York University in the School of Professional Studies. Does income inequality, because it's going to be such a big campaign issue, have an impact on giving, particularly during the holidays, on the part of people who are most in a position to give?
I wouldn't say that giving inequality per se has an impact, but we do know that people of great wealth do give differently on occasion than the average person who will make, you know, half a dozen donations at the end of the year. They have something which a researcher at Boston College by the name of Paul Skirvish called hyperagency, which means that because they have vast resources, when they make a charitable donation, they want to make a difference like all of us do, but they want to make a big difference, which is why you see a lot of mega philanthropists making enormous gifts to one institution rather than kind of sprinkling it around across a variety of different organizations.
So in a sense, the Zuckerbergs and Bill Gates's focused on the climate change conference might be an example of this, as well-meaning as the scientific giving might be to deal with climate change.
Sure. I would never cast dispersion on someone who's being philanthropic. The fact is they can leave that money to their children or buy another yacht or take another extravagant vacation. Sometimes, however, the public perceive these large gifts as trying to dictate the conversation, so to speak, around an issue. And when their wealth is so vast and the amount of money that they can contribute is so large, occasionally you'll hear criticism of them that their point of view is what's pushing the policy, so to speak, in that area. You hear this a lot in the education space with charter schools, of course, because charter schools are heavily funded by hedge fund billionaires.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this question of point of view.
Okay.
Is it possible that people who are super wealthy in communities where there are income disparities mm-hmm. Live in a certain kind of bubble, and that their demand for impact immediately maybe doesn't reflect the nuances of social change that may require a much longer term investment, and that there's a tendency to focus on short term kinds of big buildings and that sort of thing?
I actually think in some ways it's the opposite, in that your large philanthropists are often very strategic or have advisors who help them with strategy. And therefore, I feel they're willing often to support those programs or initiatives that don't have immediate impact. But the difference with people who are extraordinarily wealthy is that when you look at motivations for giving, one of the strongest motivations is a concept called identification. And this is not rocket science. It makes a lot of sense that when a donor can identify with an issue or with the ultimate recipient, the more likely they are to give, which is why you see that the percentage of people who are on the lower side of the income scale, almost the near poor, are in some ways more philanthropic than other members of the population, if you look at it as a percentage of their income, because they can identify with the person on the street who perhaps they were, or they see themselves as one layoff from the factory, that they would then be in that position.
When John D. Rockefeller needed another identity as something other than the gigantic magnate of the energy industry, he went out and invented modern philanthropy in some ways. He developed medical research.
Yes.
He created the University of Chicago. So in a variety of areas, the model was really set by John D. Rockefeller. Is it changed a lot since then, and are people more or less strategic in the same position that Rockefeller was in, more or less?
Well, you're correct in that John D. Rockefeller invented modern philanthropy. I think he really set the tone for all the generations to come. He had a philanthropy advisor by the name of Reverend Gates, who helped him.
Isn't that ironic? Isn't that so interesting?
I know. I love it. He said to him, "Mr. Rockefeller, if you don't give away your money, you will drown in it and your future generations will drown in it." He saw it as having a possible negative effect on the family long term. So Rockefeller really started this concept of making gifts where you don't necessarily get the immediate gratification. When he started, he said his favorite charity or nonprofit that he started was the Rockefeller Institute, which is now Rockefeller University. When they started that, they actually said they did not expect in their lifetimes to see any results. As it turned out, they hired brilliant researchers and they immediately began to come up with important breakthroughs in science. But I think his influence is still very, very powerful.
Finally, before we go, you mentioned, and I thought this was fascinating, that the percentage of philanthropic giving among the sort of marginally well-off comes from this identification idea that you identify with people who you might have been but for one paycheck or something. Is there a way to stimulate that? Is there a policy way to encourage something like that?
Quite honestly, and I say this with some discomfort, but I think the most important force among that part of our demographic is religion. People are stimulated to give in their churches, their synagogues, their mosques, because every religion has some predisposition for people to give. And I think that's much more important. You hear among people at the very lower end of the income spectrum that they give at their church, or their church has a soup kitchen. And they come together in a type of giving circle, so to speak, to pool their money, and then they feel real impact. But that element of our population is extraordinarily philanthropic, and I do think religion plays a role, and this sort of there but for the grace of God go I kind of motto.
Marian Stern, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Marian Stern is adjunct assistant professor at New York University in the School of Professional Studies. America's Poet Laureate Juan Felipe Herrera learned about the giving power of poetry in the hours after the shooting in Charleston, South Carolina last June that killed 9 African Americans in a prayer circle. When we reached out to poet Herrera, the just-named Laureate of the United States, we found him right on the job. He was taking seriously his responsibility to, as he told us, use poetry and language to try and name history as it happens, even violent history.
You know, it's I've been thinking about it all morning. I've been scratching and scribbling about it and thinking about what I'm going to do as a U.S. Poet Laureate, and I want to include this whole thing about violence. I was thinking about it already, but I think it's hit all of us in the face once again, and it keeps on doing this. I think it's very sad. I think it's incredible. I think about what happens in our city and our society that kind of skews us, you know, it just bends us, and we do these things. I know there's individual choices, and it's not the city's fault, and it's not, you know, it's not A or B or C. But when we lack resources, and we lack mental health services, and we lack all those support systems that all of us need to be healthy and complete human beings, we will bend and break and do terrible, ugly things to others and to ourselves. Not to mention the kind of points of view that sometimes we gather from poisonous vines or poisonous sources, and we see that others of a different color, faith, or religion, or gender, or sexual orientation are people that we can mutilate, you know, and kill, even though it's wrong, you know. We go ahead and do it. So I feel, most of all, I feel a lot of compassion for those that have been hurt and those who are hurting, and I send my condolences and my love to them.
Herrera's works are lyrics about the possibility of empathy from the perspective of a son of farm workers who grew up in poverty in a nation where people of different worlds seem to lack any emotional curiosity about the other. Here is part of his poem, Song Out There.
Can you turn around so I can look into your eyes? Just for once, your eyes, maybe like hers. Can you see her? And his. Can you see them? I want you to see them.
More with poet laureate Juan Felipe Herrera later this hour. What sets this holiday, this Christmas, apart at your home? Mistletoe, lights, maybe a tree, something entirely different? Tell us about your holiday decorations.
I'm Zach from Minneapolis, Minnesota. We always go overboard with the Christmas decorations. We're not even Christians. We just love festivities. Halloween is our favorite holiday, and we carry the pomp of Dia de los Muertos into Christmas with us. We change the colors from orange and black to red and green, but the tree always looks funky and non-conforming.
Erin Hola from Pompton Lakes. We set up our Christmas village and our tree and bake a ton of cookies, which we start eating as soon as they are out of the oven. We also wrap gifts on the dining room table. We take turns so we don't see each other's gifts and drink a lot of eggnog.
Taunton, Massachusetts, a single Festivus pole with no decorations, very high strength-to-weight ratio.
My name is Sina Saxon. I live in Richardson, Texas. And our Christmas decorations are very, very minimal. Actually, they're just holiday decorations. We try to do recyclable decorations. We use recycled product decorations. And what lights we do put up are solar powered. They each have their own little solar panel.
This is Brian from Dover, Ohio. When my wife and I first got married, we didn't have a star for our first Christmas tree. So I went to the basement and dug out my old Kinect set and built one. And 6 years later, that star still sits on the table in the dining room every single year.
Grand Prairie, Texas, put them up early and love them as long as possible. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, working to find cures for leukemia, lymphoma, Hodgkin's disease, and myeloma, improve the quality of life for patients and their families, and ensure access to treatments for patients. LLS.org.
The history of music is the story of strange and wonderful combinations. Take the Neptunes. Meet Timbaland. Neptunes and Timbaland meet Kev Marcus and Will Baptiste, violinists who within them swirl a melange of classical training, jazz, pop, and hip-hop. This is Black Violin. This track, Not Invisible, from Black Violin's latest album, Stereotypes, which dropped last September. Kev Marcus and Will B say because the violin comes with a centuries-old musical legacy, it's the perfect tool for teaching kids that music has no stereotypes.
I mean, when we first started, we really had an approach like a rapper. When we dissect songs, like our lead song on our album, Stereotypes, we were like, okay, well, we're going to do an 8-bar hook and a 16-bar verse. Like, we don't think of it, I mean, you can think of it as ABA, you know, just right, like, right, you know, right. Traditional form and counterpoint. But for us, we were thinking, you know, like, you know, you take the first verse and I take the second verse and then, you know, we do the bridge together and then the hook is just, you know, some slamming hook. So we thought of it, we always think mm-hmm. of it in form at the way pop musicians think about it, not just rappers, but pop musicians. So when you listen to our album, even a song that's completely instrumental, if you like popular music, you'll understand its form immediately. And that's how we bridge the gap, because my 5-year-old daughter will listen to a Katy Perry song and she understands the form of that song. And we take it, then take the violin and maybe a completely instrumental song, and we give it to her in that same form so she can pretty much understand it immediately.
And this is what the kids are picking up on. They may be intimidated when you pull those instruments out of the cases, but when you start doing that ABA thing, they go, oh.
Exactly. It's very relatable, and that's the thing. And we perform for the kids. I mean, they go absolutely crazy. Not only because we're doing something that seems impossible. I mean, we're taking an art form, taking a violin, and we're playing hip-hop on top of it. You know what I mean? To them, it's just like, man, this is crazy. This is cool. So I think what we're trying to do is just look at it in a different way so the kids can kind of look at the violin and not be intimidated and might possibly want to play it. And, you know, kids that would never necessarily listen to a Bach piece or a Beethoven or whatever, they can listen to that piece and appreciate it.
What if I was just coming upon you, you know, summer stoop afternoon, and I come around the corner and I hear these two violinists playing in a way that I never heard before? Can you pick up your instruments and just do something that would say to me, well, these guys are good, but they're also speaking to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Could you do that improvisationally?
Oh, that's what we do.
But let's see it. Yeah, go ahead. Pick it up.
Yeah. So, you know, you think of it, some people think of it as improvisation. We completely think of it as freestyling.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We're just going to make up something. We haven't talked about it, rehearsed it, you know. And what we'll do is one of us will kind of create a bass, and then the other person will kind of riff off of it.
You want a beat?
Oh, no, we'll make our own.
I can give you a beat. That was so nice.
That's like our favorite thing to do. I mean, we do it every night on stage because we play so many shows that, like, just for us, we want to do something brand new and fresh every night. Just, you know, and it kind of puts you on a spot and it gets your blood going. And it's also the purest form of expression because, like we were saying before, when you grow up playing the violin, you know, you're taught to, you know, sit up straight and make sure that you sustain, you know, not too much portato on most things. You're really not taught to just pick up your instrument and play whatever you feel, you know?
Gets me to my question here. So you guys were taught to sit up straight, play the violin. Where'd that come from?
Public school system.
Public school system.
We met in high school. I was in 10th grade. He was in 9th grade. And we were stand partners in orchestra class the first day of school in 1996. Mm-hmm. And that's when we met in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, in a magnet school program. Our parents didn't have money. We weren't having lessons. We just had a second period every day. We had orchestra, and we had a teacher that just cared. And, you know, he just kind of pushed us. And, you know, we lived in a neighborhood where it seemed like the only way to get out the hood would be to football or basketball or just the normal things. And he always told us, is like, you know, if you come here second period every day and you work hard and you take it home and you practice, that you can do anything. And he was right, man. We got full scholarships to college, and it's just, you know, the type of thing that keeps opening doors for us. Gosh. And, so it's great. And now we get to show people something else that they didn't think was possible. And it's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing.
What do you feel is your responsibility as an artist to speak to kids beyond the question of how to get out of the hood, or mm-hmm. how to get rich, or how to be responsible to your community, to your people, to your family, mm-hmm. to the things you love?
You know, I think as artists, and this is just me personally, I think as artists, it's our responsibility to talk to these kids and not think it's a burden. I think a lot of artists think it's a burden. I don't want kids to really look at me and look at me in a way that's like, I look up to this guy. But you sometimes, it's not even really a choice. I mean, you're a public figure. Kids look at you. You know, they want to be you. So, you know, and you're human too. You're going to make mistakes. I mean, I think admitting to your mistakes is good too. Kids can kind of see that and learn from that.
Kev Marcus and Will B, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Really
thank
appreciate
you.
It.
Kev Marcus and Will B are the duo behind the group Black Violin. Their latest album is Stereotypes. To see a video of Kev Marcus and Will B performing in our New York City studios, just visit thetakeaway.org. Hey, I know I want one. On my Christmas list this year, along with about a million other people, is one of those helicopter-looking robot drones. Have you seen them? The It toy this year perhaps skews a little older than Elmo and is starting to worry the FAA. In a moment, a member of Congress worries out loud about the proliferation of civilian drones this year. But first, a takeaway exclusive. Drones are having an impact on the seasonal workforce. We take you now to the offices of Hot Wings Aviation in East Flemington, New Jersey.
Well, I just don't know if these shoes will work for me. I said that to him. And I said, I don't care if they are 40% off. They make my ankles look ugly. Oh, Tierra, honey, I gotta go. Yeah. Yeah, let's just say some really ugly ankles just walked in here. Four of them, to be exact. All right, bye, honey. Welcome to Hot Wings Aviation. May I help? Oh, God, what is that smell?
Hi. Sorry, that's reindeer smell. Trust me, it is better in the Arctic tundra.
Oh, well, hello, Mr. Reindeer. Hey, watch where you're going.
Oh, my antlers.
Oh, my goodness. Can't you put them in some sort of a cute hat or something?
Sorry, no. Never had to worry about that sort of thing. I spent most of my time flying. That's why I'm here. I'm looking for work. Blitzen's the name, and this here is my partner. Say hello.
Prancer.
So what does that mean? You're a dancer or a flyer? I don't understand.
No, it's Prancer. That's my name, and I fly. I'm a flying reindeer. So's he. We're looking for some seasonal work.
Our regular gig has gone away.
We've been replaced. Downsized.
We're victims of automation.
Oh, that's terrible. Oh, who would fire two nice, tall...
Flying reindeer.
Right, exactly. Who would do such a thing?
It was the man with a beard who ditched us. Yeah, that Arctic blubberhead with a beard. We've been hauling around ever since.
The beginning of time, it seems. And for a lifetime of service to Santa, we get...
Dumped for a bunch of drones.
Drones. These annoying little robot flyers have driven Santa drone crazy. If you were at the North Pole right now, you would not believe what was going on.
That's good. Put a few more boxes on. Look at that, elves. Load up those drones. We can ditch this old sleigh finally.
We can program these drones right down to the street address for as many trips as you'd like, Santa.
We've done the math, Santa. 20 million drones, 2 trips each, 6 packages per trip.
Woohoo! No more filthy chimneys.
That should just about do it, Santa.
That's Christmas! And I can just hang out here next to the eggnog bowl all night.
But what about us?
Oh, right, reindeer. We'll have to think about that one. How about some extra reindeer chow? Would that make you happy?
Reindeer chow, nice.
You see what I mean? This drone thing is just not thought through. The implications.
I hear you, but Santa, he's got top clearance from the FAA. He can do whatever he wants.
Could we work for FedEx?
Oh, FedEx? No, they're union only.
How about Amazon?
Oh, come on, give me a break. You think they're not 10 steps ahead of Santa on the drone thing? You are way too low-tech for Jeff Bezos. Maybe you'd like some reindeer chow, though, huh? A little chow-chow?
Pass.
Thinking through the drone revolution there. We'll talk seriously about that coming right up. But tell us a drone story. What would you use yours for? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Here's the FAA's real problem with drones.
1982, Roger. Change to runway 13 right, clear to land. We got a report of a drone on a 1 mile final for the left side, 1,000 feet. We're trying to get the police helicopter in the area to see if we can find it.
Okay, we're transitioning it over to 13 right. No problem, Southwest 1982.
That happened this past summer in Dallas. A Southwest Airlines jet had to change runways at Dallas-Fort Worth International after reports of a drone in the flight path. The FAA has released drone guidelines and voluntary registration for drones that weigh more than 55 pounds. But Representative Peter DeFazio, Democrat of Oregon and ranking member on the House of Representatives Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, says if you're flying reindeer, you're out of a job.
You got to be dodging those drones. Hopefully Santa is not going to be delivering drones or delivering packages with drones, although, you know, that's probably not too far off in the future with some of our large commercial companies. That's the other side of this. We want to move ahead with the beneficial uses of the technology. I mean, for instance, we've had people interfere with forest firefighting, having to ground the firefighting aircraft because they were operating illegally to look at the fire and take photos. But actually, the firefighters themselves can use the drones and get them into areas to look for hot spots and things where we can't get aircraft. My wine growers, there's ways that they can tell, the health of the grapes in the field and other parts of agriculture for irrigation or fertilization. There's tremendous commercial potential. So we've got to move ahead on the commercial track where things will be heavily regulated and licensed, but not to the point where we're going to, discourage the technology. At the same time, the more casual users have to be educated. They have to know the rules. They have to know they can't operate over 400 feet. They have to know they can't operate in critical airspace. They have to know they can't operate over sporting events or in public places like that. And we have to have at least put in place the beginnings of a system to track when people do violate and hopefully ultimately a system where we can find that person real time while they're operating.
How nervous do you get every time you see a picture of a public space depicted from a drone from the air that's posted on YouTube, like was the case for the Thanksgiving Day parade in New York City?
Well, there are certainly safety issues, particularly as you get to heavier, larger drones that are being operated over crowded spaces. In many cases, these are at the moment illegal operations, so they aren't being done by licensed commercial operators. We're moving ahead with licensing commercial operators for certain functions and operations. But one falling out of the sky, injuring someone, killing someone, that wouldn't be good. That's possible. So people need to know, what the risks are and what their restrictions are. And then even worse, one runs into a commercial aircraft. The FAA, I asked them, I said, okay, what happens when a jet engine ingests a drone? And they said, that's a good question. We've tested turkeys. We haven't done drones. So now at my request, they are plodding ahead with a test of ingestion of drones into turbine engines. And it, particularly with ones of any size, total failure, perhaps uncontained failure of a jet engine is very possible. Pilots have reported seeing these things at altitude, on approach, very dangerous.
Well, if a drone is on your holiday gift list, you've got some learning to do from the ranking member on the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, Representative Peter DeFazio, Democrat from Oregon. Thanks so much.
Thanks for the opportunity. Appreciate it.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, which has funded research that led to blood cancer treatments such as chemotherapy and stem cell transplants. And more recently, targeted therapies and immunotherapies to save thousands of lives. More at lls.org. Curious.com. Committed to helping people learn something new every day with more than 20,000 lessons on stock market tips, storytelling, shaken cocktails, and more. Learn more at curious.com/PRI. Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with the New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Never look a gift horse in the mouth. Does anyone really understand what that saying means? What about a gift crow? Now that I can get my head around. Here's a story of some friendly little crows who met a little girl in Seattle, and well, since the crows couldn't write or talk, they used the universal language of gifting to get the little girl's attention. Katie Sewell, senior producer and host of the Bittersweet Life podcast, profiled the young girl named Gabby Mann and asked a real crow expert, John Marsliff, if gifting crows was a thing. He's at the University of Washington, and it turns out it was a thing, as real as the dreams of little girls.
Gabby Mann is an 8-year-old girl who lives in the city of Seattle who gets gifts regularly from crows that she feeds in her backyard. Little shiny trinkets. I found out about her from John Marsliff, who is a scientist at the University of Washington. And apparently Gabby knew about John because of his extensive research on crows, and so she brought in her collection to him for him to look at.
Well, there are three things here. There's, you know, what's going on in the mind of the crow. That's the biggest mystery. Then there's the stuff itself and whether the collection of stuff actually suggests a motive that involves some deeper morality other than random garbage that crows would pick up. And then there's Gabby herself. What is she like, and why do you think she might be touched by crows versus some of the rest of us?
She is very interested in nature. In fact, she often refers to herself as Nature Girl, or she'll say that that's what the crows call her. And when she started getting these crow gifts, she sort of approached it like a scientist would in a way, where she not only kept the gifts, but she started bagging them and putting them in order so that she has little plastic bags that are labeled with the date, where she found the gift, what time of day it was, those things. So she almost is approaching it from a scientific aspect as well. But she also has a very rich imagination. So these objects are not only a rock, it's a stone from the seven seas that the crows flew out and picked up for her special and brought it back.
This is a heart from them. It's showing me how much they love me. This, it's kind of like a keychain. They gave it to me and it says best, and I don't know if they have the part that says friend.
But they haven't given that to you yet?
No.
Great question, I have to say. So that's still out there.
Don't you love that she imagines, though, that one of these crows has a little piece of metal that says friend on it? That's just like you would with your best friend. It's wonderful.
So what does a scientist at the University of Washington think about this phenomenon and the collection itself?
Well, John says that it could be that in some ways these crows are courting the family, just as they would a mate.
I have seen an awful lot of things crows have brought people. Certain individual crows,
the bond they form with that person might be even a kind of a courtship bond where they're bringing presents like they would to their mates, courtship feeding, for example. So some people, their presents are dead baby birds. Other people, they're beautiful pendants or shiny glass or trinkets of all sorts. And if you're lucky enough that the bird that really is conditioned to you is a gifter, then yeah, it's going to be awesome.
And a lot of times these gifts are not just, you know, picked out special. They're picked out to encourage the behavior that the family is doing. So the family's putting out food. The crows think that's a good thing, so they're giving something back.
So this is part of a conversation between a family, Gabby and her mom, Lisa, for instance, and the birds who benefit from what it is they're putting out for these birds. Let's listen to the human family talk about this.
We know this is from the crows because sometimes they're rusted and dirty and nothing that a person would carry around.
And do they leave them in particular places or do you just find them on the ground?
Yeah, sometimes in the bird feeders and stuff.
The feeders on the tables, and sometimes you'd see, especially next to the water bowls, some small little doodad sitting there.
Can you make it happen? Is there a methodology for going beyond simply bird feeders and getting bird gifts?
I wish you could. Not that they know of as scientists, but John also points out, though, that if you feed ritually at the same time and maybe use some sort of a noise that signals that you're about to feed them, maybe you rattle something or you use peanuts in the shell so that they make a clicking sound when they hit the ground, if you're really routine about it, your chances are higher because you'll start making a pattern with these crows. But still, no guarantees because you also have to have a crow in your neighborhood that is a gifter.
Well, all I want them to do is to just go get like a Rolex watch or something.
You know what's so funny is that Gabby's mother lost one of her diamonds from her wedding ring, and she was hoping so much that the crows would find it and bring it back, and they never did. Her conclusion to that was that she probably lost it in the house, so they had no way to find it. But yes, we all wish that they would bring us something that is a treasure rather than a chicken bone. But birds pick what they pick, right, John?
Now, how is this, I don't know, how is this like a lesson we can take with us as opposed to just a crow version of cute squirrel videos online, you know what I mean?
Well, I think the very interesting thing about this story, and I think why so many people have been interested in it, is it just gives you a different perspective on nature in the sense that sometimes we think of nature as just something that's going on that doesn't involve us, and we forget that we're a part of nature and nature actually, animals do interact with us to a certain degree, that we are all living in an ecosystem and we can interact with one another. And something about this story, like the idea that a crow would so particularly engage with a little girl is magical. It makes you feel like it's not bird and human, it's human and bird together, being able to talk with one another in their own ways.
It's a crow's world.
It is if we let it be, I guess.
Katie, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Katie Sewell is senior producer and host of the Bittersweet Life podcast and a former senior producer with KUOW in Seattle.
The Takeaway is supported by Squarespace, providing tools to create a professional website. Learn more at squarespace.com/takeaway. Squarespace, build it beautiful.
The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
In the months since learning of becoming the first U.S. poet laureate who is Mexican-American, Juan Felipe Herrera has been thanking people and asking for their poems. He told a Washington, D.C. audience this fall that he does this in honor of a patient California third-grade teacher who once told him he had a beautiful voice at a time when he was really insecure about his English and much more about his new home in the U.S. Herrera's teacher, Mrs. Sampson, is 94 now, and he's still thanking her in everything he does.
It's really an invitation. I'm inviting everybody to
to really let their poetry come out and to share it, translate it, play with it, throw it all the way so I can catch it, and then throw it all the way back and maybe make a big old circle around the globe. My message is, play with life with your words.
And you do play with language, and language is pretty important to your work because as a Chicano, you describe the border of the United States, of America's Spanish heritage, Mexican heritage, and English-speaking heritage. It's all mixed together in your work and the world that you describe.
Well, you know, that's right. You know, the more cultures, the more histories, the more words, and the more compassion, the more of an embrace and multiple embraces that we can generate with our words, our language, and our breath and our writing. For me, it's a good thing. Less borders, less barriers, less hindrances, less violence. That's what I'm after. I think we're all after that.
What are you looking forward to doing during this next year? You described travel, at least in the abstract, a moment ago. Is that something literally you want to do?
Yes, it is. You know, I think the more travel we get into, the more we drive through communities and stop in communities and stick around, say hello, listen, take notes, get jarred, recreate ourselves because we thought we had it together, and then we find out that we actually didn't. When someone tells us, you know, I just wrote a poem about rape, and you know, here I am thinking about choirs, and I go, yes, choirs are important, and I will do choir work and voice ensembles, but I hadn't been stopped, even though I have thought about all this, have been concerned about issues of rape and violence against women. Yesterday, I went to one of my favorite art stores in Fresno, California. My friend's there. She says, I just finished writing a poem about rape. And I go, of course, you know. Jeez, this is big. It's very big. And why hadn't I thought about it? And now I'm thinking about it. This is something that's very important. It's an extreme, powerful, important, significant experience to write about. If we can write about it, let's write about it. And let's say it, if we can say it. And she was telling me about it. And that's why it's good to move around, to get out of our small rooms, small buses, and meet people and let them smack us with their truth and stop us, because actually, I didn't know it. I didn't know it all. I don't know it all. And the more I hear things, the more I move around from place to place, the more I see things, and the more I include things. That's why it's so important.
Does that encounter change, knowing that you are a poet laureate and that you have some kind of responsibility, and that this omission of yours suddenly seems much more significant than it might have in the past?
Yes, exactly. It's about change. And it's about, you know, personal change. It's about just stopping our thoughts, embracing and taking in and thinking, and stopping the thinking machine too, and getting much deeper to those very painful places, those horrible experiences that I have had and others have had, and pulling them up, dredging them up. And maybe we're not going to say it all, but let's test ourselves. Yes, that's what it is. It's about change. And it's that kind of change. It's not I have an idea change. It's emptying myself, starting over kind of change.
Can I ask you to invite us into your thinking machine, your idea machine, your engine? How did you approach this subject as a poet? What words did you choose? How did you play around with them? And, you know, you don't have to tell me what you came up with necessarily, but I'd love to know how your mind works.
It's about going up. It's about going back or going into my deep present, about my early childhood experiences. It's about how much pain I experienced as a child, the kind of difficult, painful, poverty world I lived in, and how ashamed I felt, and how it just ravaged me. And my mother was very supportive, of course, and my father was very supportive. It's not about them. It's just about that terrible feeling of being so far away from what's going on, and being brown and being poor and being mistreated by teachers, by other kids, by men, and trying to hide it and not being able to talk about it and feeling ashamed.
Poverty is a form of violence.
It's a form of violence. And so until when Lucille Sampson in third grade asked me to come up in front of class and sing. So I came up in front of the class somehow and sang. And then she turned to me and said, "You have a beautiful voice." I understood the English by then, and I didn't understand the phrase, because how could it ever apply to me? So it was like something just going by me, yet it was for me. From that day on, I had this compliment or encouragement that was next to me and always was with me, yet I never really turned around to embrace it until I was stopped again in sixth grade. Mr. Robert Hayden said, "Why don't you do theater in this class and create a story and perform it with the students?" I said, "Why are you telling me that? I have no idea what that means. How come you have that kind of faith in me? I never even thought of something like that." So he did have confidence, and I did do it. And then in seventh grade, Mr. Schuster said, "What are you?" in my music class, and I said, "Hawaiian." But I said, "I'm lying, even though I wish I could be Hawaiian, because I had just come back from San Francisco, but I was Mexican, and I wasn't able to say it." So then I said, that's it. I said to myself, I'm stopping this whole train that's taking me, that's off the rails and going down some cliff into an abyss. I'm going to have to step into choir, and where I know the teacher is going to ask me to step forward and sing in front of everybody every day. Until I do that, year after year, will I be more comfortable and be able to speak up, because I want to speak up. I want to be that person that speaks up and is sincere and is not afraid today.
And you're definitely up in front of the class, that's for sure.
I'm in front of the class. Yeah. Yes, that's true.
Juan Felipe Herrera, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Juan Felipe Herrera is the United States Poet Laureate. And here's something to take with you today. Among the many Christmas traditions you've shared with us from all over the U.S. and the world, I want to call out two you may not have heard of and which you might want to try. Greenlanders feast on raw whale skin and blubber with a side dish of kiviak, which is auk meat stuffed in a seal carcass for months and buried until it decomposes. Or if you don't want to try that and are pressed for time, do what the Japanese do on Christmas and go to KFC for a bucket. Extra crispy. Have an extra crispy Merry Christmas. This is The Takeaway. Thanks for listening.
Want more information about the stories you hear on The Takeaway? Check out thetakeaway.org for more facts, figures, and news from guests and contributors and opinions from your fellow listeners. You can also check out the latest John Hockenberry blog post and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a note or comment on a story you heard, all at thetakeaway.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.